Welcome to Integrate This, your go-to EdTech podcast where curiosity meets classroom innovation. Join your hosts, David Berner and Jeremy Mikla, as we explore the rapidly evolving world of educational technology. From game-changing tools to insightful conversations with today's top EdTech voices, we're here to help educators stay informed, inspired, and ready to innovate. So tune in, level up, and let's integrate this.
Welcome to the Integrate This EdTech podcast. I'm David Berner, as always, joined by my co-host, Jeremy Mikla. And today we're very excited to announce a guest that we have joining us, AI ethics researcher and keynote speaker, Rebecca Boltzma. We actually were passing ships in the in a recent summer institute that took place in Owatonna, Minnesota. And so I wanted to reach out to Rebecca. We kind of follow each other on LinkedIn, and I see a lot of the work that you're doing. And so I'll just give you a moment to introduce yourself and some of the things that you do. But we're very pleased to have you join us.
Thank you so much. I'm honestly thrilled to be here. Such a professional setup. I feel borderline famous being on this fancy podcast. So thank you for having me. Really, all I do is I talk about generative AI. I kind of live in this messy space between I use it all the time. Every new product that comes out, I experiment with. I can tell you about all the features of every large language model, and I use them all. And then I research artificial intelligence ethics at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland and really just look at all the ways this can go horribly wrong. And then I just try and exist in the middle, and I talk about things all along that pendulum and try and make sense of them in public and try and help other people who are trying to make sense of it too.
Yeah. And one of the things I was going to mention too is that, so you're not currently in Canada, right? Or are you?
I am in Canada. And funny story, I had a class in Edinburgh this morning at 2 a.m. my time. I have to be there like in person, air quotes. And so I had a class at 2 a.m. and now it's 8 a.m. where I am. So it's like, okay. Me.
Yeah. And so I got to ask, what are things like, is it very similar? Cause you know, like I mentioned, you come to the States and you've done keynotes here and everything. And, what is the comparison between like what's going on in Canada around these conversations and the US? Are you seeing like differences in that?
I actually do the majority of my work in the US. I don't know that there's the same level of things happening in Canada yet. Like we don't have the equivalent of what I know some states have, like Ohio, statewide kind of legislation around AI and education. EdTech isn't as big of a thing up in Canada as it is in the US. And so right now, people are just kind of left to their own figuring it out. Individual schools are doing PD up here, but I would say nobody in like my immediate life knows much about generative AI, cares much about generative AI. And it's not a conversation that's happening a ton, at least in the spaces that I'm a part of.
Okay. Yeah. Well, maybe that'll continue to expand as you move forward, but yeah.
Yeah. So when we think about kind of like your background here, right? Your background isn't necessarily coming from a K-12 space, but yet you're definitely, I think, out there, at least not just in the technology side of things, the AI side of things, but also I think on the communication side of things, right? You know, can you describe how you can take your background and experience and, you know, give it that educational, that ed tech type spin?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting backstory, and it's an interesting like conglomerate of all these different fields. But my background is in communications and public relations. But actually, for the last 8 years, I worked in a K-12 district running there at director of comms. And so I worked directly with the superintendent and the executive leadership team in all the meetings, helping make all the decisions. And so I really had a really good firsthand look and understanding of how things work on the back end, how ed leadership works, how they make decisions about educational technology, and really saw kind of the value of like public engagement and making things easy for people to understand. As a communicator my whole life, I've just tried to take things that are complex and distill them down for an audience and make them easy to understand. And so when generative AI came along, I was trying to understand it right when ChatGPT came out. And I couldn't find anyone who could explain it to me. The only people who understood it were like data science guys who would just start talking about transformer architecture and deep learning and neural networks. And I couldn't understand it. And I couldn't find anyone to explain it to me. So I started taking these complex concepts around AI and how it worked, reading about them, and then just trying to make them easy to understand and put them in my own words and then share them on my LinkedIn to maybe help other people understand it. I started doing that at my district too, and seeing what landed and what didn't. And then from there, I started speaking at like K-12 communicators conferences. And then I think superintendents were probably like, hey, do you know anyone who knows about AI? And their comms people, who are usually like the right-hand people, were like, yeah, it just kind of ended up bleeding all together. And the more I knew, the more freaked out I got, which is how I ended up on the research end of things. So that's kind of the high level of the story.
And one of the things too that you emphasize is the human-centric piece to this. I think like even in our, you know, with our some of our work and our Minnesota Department of Education put out some guiding principles. And one of the main ones there was human-centered. So, you know, focusing on that. In your work and the things that you're doing, can you talk a bit about what that means to you, like the human-centric concept and how that differs from just using AI tools? Because these are conversations that we've had a lot where it happens so quickly that there are all these tools that are already available for teachers. But what does that mean to you when someone says like human-centric AI?
I see a couple of different directions with that. I think we need to think about it like that human in the loop, human-centric, because generative AI, like large language models, they hallucinate, they make mistakes, they don't get things right, which means we need to have the human eyes on it before things go out in the world to make sure that we're not putting something out that reflects like a really biased or outdated stereotype. We know that it was trained on the internet, so it was trained on, you know, a data set, the history of humanity that kind of doesn't necessarily reflect how we think today. You know, why it would maybe give you outputs that reflected very traditional families or gender roles or cultural stereotypes. So human in the loop and human centric, make sure that there's actual context on the AI stuff that might be wrong. On the other side, I think the human centered piece is important just from like a future ethical point of view of making sure we don't make ourselves irrelevant. Like we have to figure out how to work with this technology and incorporate it into what we're already doing so that we don't risk just, you know, putting ourselves out of work or making ourselves obsolete. So I think if we learn to work with it, with humans at the center and using it to enhance and augment us, that kind of human-centric matters on that side, but then also for accuracy and making sure that the outputs make sense and aren't causing harm. Both sides have to do with harm, but that's a couple of the reasons I think that human-centric, human in the loop is so important.
You know, there's this video that I show in this one AI presentation that I give, and I think it's touching on kind of what you're saying here. And it is this, it's not necessarily AI directly, right? But it's, should we be turning over to technology things that should be empathetically human? And in the video, it's these two kids I think their mom works in the local nursing home, and they have these little, they're like cat robots that purr and stuff when you pet them. Right. And so they went around and they raised some money and they were able to buy two of these cat robots, and they bring them into the nursing home, and the residents there just love them because they can pet the cat and it looks like it's interacting with them. And it's kind of helping making them feel, you know, I guess just more comfortable. I'm not exactly sure, but then, you know, and I present this video and I share it, and everyone just thinks it's so cute and lovely that these cats robots are making these residents feel better. And I'm just thinking, yes, that's great. These kids are super innovative, and, you know, hats off to them for showing like design thinking and the process of trying to solve a problem, you know, but at the same time, isn't that more naturally a role that a human could play in offering that comfort and support to those people in need? And I see that as, then I present that as a moment and people are like stopping and thinking like, oh, just because AI can do something for us, doesn't mean it always should.
Yeah, that's a great point. And actually, I'm just building a keynote right now. And I forgot that that was in Jurassic Park. I don't know if you guys remember, there was actually a quote in Jurassic Park where they...
Like the first one.
Yeah. Yeah. Where they basically say like, just because we can do something doesn't mean that we should. But I have actually mixed feelings on this because I think about it a lot. And I think about a lot of the harm that came about from the pandemic and people being lonely and people ending up with even more mental health issues than normal in a system that can't necessarily support everybody. There's wait lists for therapists. There's people who need care and can't get it. And so part of me wonders, is it better than nothing if people feel like they can get some sort of emotional connection, even if it is artificial? Is it better than nothing until you can get a human? Does it demonstrate to us that how necessarily important that human piece is and how we'll never really fully replace humans, because we would probably all rather talk to a real human expert? We have to make sure that this tool, if people are using it out of desperation, isn't causing harm, which we're seeing some people who are using it as a therapist, it leading them way down the wrong path. So I think there's a lot of things to be thinking about there. And then also something else I've been thinking about is, if you have this close relationship, let's say as a therapist or as a friend with a large language model, which isn't as weird as it sounds, like I really get into conversations with about different topics. Lots of people do with their large language models now. It's actually the number one use case is advice and therapy for large language models. But as we kind of go down that path, we become less tolerant of, like, say, your best friend or your sister who has bad days or off days or struggles or isn't always available to you. Do we just automatically turn to what's easy, even if it's artificial, instead of what's meaningful and human and what actually builds connection? So that's, again, one of those tensions that we see, right?
Right. Kind of the, you know, when it's better than the best human available to you at that time kind of concept.
And what's best, right? Like, is it better and best because it's always available and endless? Or if you can't have real meaningful dialogue with it, which a lot of the research tells us it's not actual meaningful dialogue unless it's two-way and both people are getting something out of it, then how helpful is it? And is it better than nothing? Sorry, you're talking to an ethicist. I see every side of everything and it's kind of abstract sometimes.
We're trying to get you to commit to one particular thing. You here, come on.
I don't think I've ever done that in my whole life.
Yeah. Well, I think you've kind of started to touch on some of these here as well, but like, you know, maybe there's some room to expand upon. Where do you see like some of the biggest opportunities in education technology for the integration of AI?
So one of the things I think about a lot is in business and in AI, we do what's called foresight and forecasting. You've heard of business forecasting, mm-hmm. where you kind of predict what's going to happen. And a lot of those frameworks have been applied to AI. And one of the visuals that I like is a futures cone. And you kind of picture it like, a cheerleader, you know, one of those cheerleader cones that they yell through when they're trying to get the crowd hyped up. But it shows that from any point in time, there are endless numbers of possibilities that are plausible, that could potentially happen, that are possible, that are, you know, things maybe we wouldn't like, things that would be optimal. And so I think you have to think through every possible, like it could go here, it could go here, it could go here. And knowing that it'll probably land somewhere in the middle. And I think about things like that a lot. I think we get to choose a lot of what happens and where those end up, which I like, but I don't think there's a lot of active choosing happening right now. I think that everything's just kind of happening so fast that it's happening to us and we're not making conscious choices about it. So the future of education will really depend on the decisions that we're making about it right now, that lawmakers are making about what's allowed and not allowed, how damaging it is to students, either banning the technology, right? You're not preparing for a workforce where they're going to be using it forever, or not training educators how to use it properly. There's a lot of data security risks. But the future of education, I think, is going to look very, very different than the way we understand it now and the way that it's been for the last 200 years, which I don't think is a bad thing. I know there's a lot of models on both sides, from ultra traditional to now there's like the Alpha School that basically has these learning guides, and they have kids working with AI to deliver them the banking model of education, which is, I am going to make deposits into your knowledge bank, and it is your job to accept them and put them into your brain. And then the rest of the time, they get to explore things that they're actually interested in. And I like a lot of things about that, but I also think that that human teacher element is super important. That's been demonstrated through research. That relationality piece has got to be critical. So I hope it ends up somewhere in the middle in a way that benefits more kids than I think the traditional education is benefiting right now.
So teachers aren't afraid, or they don't need to be as afraid of losing their jobs to AI, because that human part is still necessary. They're going to need to accept that the way they do their job is changing.
I think to a point, I think what matters about teaching is going to stay the same. If you're a teacher because you love kids and you love helping them learn and grow and see endless possibilities for their futures and think bigger and differently about things, that's not going to change. If you love standing in front of a class and lecturing and assigning essays, you might not love teaching in 5 to 10 years. Like it might not look like that. And I think that teachers and the educators and all professionals that need to worry about AI taking their jobs are the ones who refuse to acknowledge AI, decide they're not going to learn it, decide it doesn't matter, and decide that it's bad and it's evil and it's a fad. I think if you're thinking along the lines of any of those things, you might have to worry about your job in 5 to 10 years, because you're not going to be able to deliver education in the way that it's heading, in the same way that will be effective for students. If you're hell-bent on always assigning the same essay you've assigned for 15 years in this exact way, you're going to be very disappointed when kids are using AI to generate it, because every single other teacher permits it in their class, and kids won't conform to the old way of thinking in education. It's just not going to work.
Yeah, it's a great point too, because there is some element where, you know, like you're kind of saying, that teachers have to be willing to adjust to some extent because of the reality that their students are using these. And I like what you said there about, like, if you're doing the same thing that you've done for the last 15 years, it's time to maybe rethink different approaches of what that could look like, and not just trudging down the same road, yielding, you know, zero or negative results. But and that kind of touches on, you know, the future a bit, with what's kind of coming and what teachers should be thinking about. If you were to think about the current risks that are happening right now, with like ethical considerations, what would be your top 2 to 3 things? Like, if a administration, if they're trying to tackle AI use in their school, with their teachers and, you know, or just their staff in general, and with students, what in your mind are the top 2 to 3 things they need to ask themselves first with what is currently going on this year?
I think the idea of like risks and AI ethics gets super overwhelming for people, because there are so many and they're all scattered, like swirling all over the place. And you just have to kind of reach up into the cloud and pull one down, and there's so many. And so I've started thinking about it in terms of like 3 buckets, right? Like, we have the big bucket that is things that you should probably be aware of, but you can't change. Like, we can't change how these models were trained. They give biased output. We can't change right now directly that they're harming the environment. These are big ethical issues, right? Mis- and disinformation crisis. These are big ethical issues we can't control. We should probably be aware of them. We're going to put those in that bucket. There's a bucket that's, as an individual, your ethical AI use of these tools as an individual, what you can control, right? Checking your outputs, how you think about these tools, what you let them do for you, how transparent you are in using them. And then in the middle, there's the ethical considerations for organizations and things that we maybe influence, but we don't directly own, but are still within our control. So those issues for like a school leader would be things like making sure, well, I think a big one that's been top of mind for me lately is creating opportunities for your staff to learn and understand, making it safe for them to fail, incentivizing innovation, right? Saying, you know what, we're going to learn this together about generative AI every Friday for an hour. We're going to give you time to do this. We're actually going to have a contest to, or some sort of way that we can share the great tools and the ways that we're coming up with this and the people who share the most often, or, you know, incentivizing people and creating a culture of sharing and openness that gives people permission to fail, I think is really underrated, because a lot of people are scared, because a lot of us grew up in cultures where you have to be right and there's no real opportunity or room for failure. You feel all this pressure. And so people are just paralyzed and they don't even want to start. So creating safe spaces like that for conversation, I think will be like a big ethical direction that leaders can actually control and set. You can't control if the state is going to put in curriculum for generative AI or what your funding for that looks like. But what you can control is helping to empower people, however you decide to do it, especially your teachers. I think that's the most important conversation to have right now. Yes, kids are going to be using it, but until like the educators and the leaders understand it, they can't teach kids how to use it. They can't police it properly. That needs to be the top priority, is helping educators and leaders figure this out, experiment with it, feel safe, fail. And having some flexible guidelines or guiding principles in place with a few kind of hardcore-ish policies about what to do and not do with student data, which already exist. But I think that's probably the next best step forward.
Do you think that because of the nature of how this was released and the AI tools being so much like ed tech tools of the past, do you think that's why a lot of people, a lot of teachers were thinking, oh, just block it? You think it's because they were equating that to ed tech tools of the past, and this is very different?
Possibly. Dr. Sarah Eaton is a researcher, like a professor at the University of Calgary, and she talks about this kind of cycle within education where a new technology emerges and everybody's excited and scared by it. And then they adopt it, they figure out how to use it. Kids and teachers put in guardrails, kids figure out how to cheat, and then a new technology comes in. And it's just this cycle. But I think we've seen the exact same thing happen every time, right? With calculators, with the internet, probably with encyclopedias back in the day. Oh no, everyone can have an encyclopedia at home. Now they are going to cheat. So I think it's just been how it's always been. But all of those things we were able to, they couldn't do your work for you necessarily, right? And we developed tools to kind of catch them. This feels different, at least to me, because it actually can substitute for thinking. We can cognitively offload as teachers, as professionals, as students to these actual critical processes. So with calculators, you still had to know what numbers to put in what order, right? With this, it's harder to show your thinking. So I think this is different, and we probably have reacted the way we've always reacted. It's human nature. We don't like change. We want things to stay as they are because we think how things are is the best way. And you're right. The fact that this dropped available to society all on one day without an instructor manual for free is different than anything we've ever seen. I lived in the country when the internet came out, and so we didn't get it for a long time. And when we did, it was dial-up. And, you know, lots of people had the internet before I did. So it rolled out. We've never seen something happen this quick on this scale that is this powerful and this much of a threat to education as we know it, in my opinion.
Well, there's some things that you mentioned in there that I feel like I want to unpack a little bit here. And you brought up so many great points. I'm not sure where I want to start with it. But I think one of them here is you bring up cognitive offloading, and it is definitely something David and I have talked quite a bit about. And I think it's almost human nature in a way to try to find that easy button. And I think it's easy for students to do that, but I think it's also can be easy for teachers to be able to do that too. Oh, you know, I want to revamp this lesson plan because I just feel like it's time to give it a fresh start. I'm just going to turn that all over to AI and I'm just going to take it and use it, even though we all know that wouldn't be best practice. But yet again, we know it's out there and we know that it's happening. But I think it brings in this idea too, that you have these ed tech companies, you know, just to name a few, maybe like a School AI, a Magic School, CuraPod, and a whole bunch of others that I think are out there for really good reasons. And I think they are trying to be on that cutting edge of, you know, hey, we want you to use these tools, but we want you to use them in a safe manner with students. We want you to use them in an ethical way. But yet at the same time, they're giving us the easy button to push. So why would we just not push it? Right. But at the same time, you know, you talk about being an ethicist and you can see both sides of it at the same time. So yes, I see the easy button side, but I also see all of the ways that AI could be used to enhance critical thinking, to take an idea that you have and take it to that next level, you know, and I think, you know, it definitely there are times where, and I'm going to pick on English teachers here for just a moment or two, but, you know, you've assigned that same essay like you talked about for the last 15 years. Well, yeah, AI can help you write a better one, and students can cheat that way. But students have, you know, forever have had older siblings, and they can go find that same essay their older sibling wrote and use that as a way to cheat. So I don't see it as a process of eliminating cheating, but can we find ways to create better assessments that are going to make students have to prove that they still had to think their way through this problem?
That's the number one question, really, because when you peel back all the layers, it's not necessarily, or it shouldn't be, about the essay. It should be what you want students to gain during that process of writing the essay, those skills you want them to develop. And you need to be able to know that they understand what they're talking about. And like, full disclosure, like, I am not a teacher. I educate people about AI. I am a student, so I use AI in a lot of those really, really critical ways that you've mentioned to help me think differently about research or make connections between random things or test the limits of my understanding because I know how to leverage the tool in that way, but not very many people do. I have mixed feelings about ed tech because anything that draws money away from education that could potentially stay in education is preferable for me. But yeah, your question about assessments is good. One of the first things I encourage when I'm training schools or teachers to do is to give their assessment to AI and tell it to tell them all the ways that a student could use generative AI to cheat on the assignment and help them come up with different ways to assess the core skills that they're looking to assess that might be AI proofed. I like to think this is kind of offbeat, but I really think that we are going to probably evolve more towards some sort of an oral society. Again, I think we've overcorrected so far to texting and email. And now that large language models can imitate that so well, I wonder if the only way I'm going to know that my student understands the concepts critically is if they explain it to me and support with evidence and use rhetoric in Socratic styles and engage with each other through that reflective learning process verbally, because you know that if it's coming out of their mouth, it's coming out of their brain and it's not coming from anywhere else. So I wonder if we're going to see more of that in the future.
I could just see Socrates coming back in that Bill and Ted's time machine phone booth and saying how great it would be if everyone just verbalized everything, because wasn't he the one that was like, thought putting in writing
what?
Be like a way of taking your ideas away from you. So,
you know, old things always become new again, things come back around. And I have to wonder, and, you know, teachers automatically go to, well, how am I gonna, I don't have time to listen to every, you know, but if you don't have all of the other things to worry about, let's say, and your only job is to sit and engage in dialogue and listening with students, and that's all you had to do as a teacher and help redirect and help them understand, wouldn't that be fun? Wouldn't that be amazing? Wouldn't that face-to-face all the time, if that was your big job? I think that would be amazing. I think most teachers would think that was amazing. I don't think anyone loves lesson planning or writing, marking papers or doing all that administrative stuff. So maybe that's where we end up, and maybe people like it better.
Yeah. And early on too, I know some of our conversations with teachers were when it was, first released and we had all the conversations about the plagiarism and kids turning in their papers that weren't theirs. We talked a lot about how can you adjust or extend your assessment so that it actually challenges the student to, what is it that you know about this topic? So if they turn in a paper, is there follow-up questions that you hand them maybe on a sheet of paper that they have to write out? Or like you said, is it like an oral assessment that follows the work that was done? And I think it does, it's a great point that it does give us opportunities to talk to students more, as opposed to just your paper's due, turn it in, I'll review it, give it back. Maybe will eliminate that and have more conversations around what students actually know, and the student or the teacher can engage them in that more. So that's it's really interesting.
And then that relationship piece becomes more important too, right? And kids are learning how to interact with each other and with adults and articulate their ideas. And maybe they're not scared to call and make doctor's appointments or, make an actual phone call, because they're so used to being able to draft a text and have this rehearsal method on everything they do that, that real life interaction is so scary. And I can say this with authority because I have 4 kids in college. So I've seen firsthand, this kind of transition to just hiding behind a screen. And I just don't know if it's going to work anymore, at least not in education.
Yeah. So can you talk a little bit about, there's been a huge number of frameworks and things that have come out. What do you see, what's your full opinion on prompting frameworks and things of that nature? Because Jeremy and I have kind of gone back and forth in our own conversations about our preferred frameworks that we use or train teachers to use, or even Jeremy has brought it before, moving away from the frameworks, and that is a popular approach too. When you're looking at all these, or the things that come across your desk, what's your opinion on the frameworks, and is there one that is best, or what's the best approach?
When I teach people about how to talk to AI or effective ways to interact with AI, I give them kind of 4 approaches, and really it's going to work differently for everybody. It's like everything else. It's the reason they make cars in different colors, right? You don't have cars in different colors. They all do the same thing, but everyone likes something a little bit different. I do think they're, especially when people are starting out, some people really like a framework, right? Give me the recipe so I at least feel like I know what I'm doing. And probably that's what you guys did to start. That's probably what I did to start. And then from there, you feel more comfortable kind of going off script. So the framework that I talk about the most, or that I recommend, is actually from Google. It's very standard. I have it's so easy to come up with an acronym that does basically the same thing. But really, you just need something that gives it a task, tell it what to do, give it a persona. That's the most critical part, at least right now. Make it an expert in a pedagogical reasoning, the best in the world, award-winning lasagna chef, whatever it is. And then tell it what format you want the output in. And I can't even pull the other one off the top of my head. Task, persona, format, whatever the other Google one is. They're all basically about the same. I have another one for teachers specifically that's clear. Give it lots of context. Tell it what length you want the response in. Give it a bunch of examples to choose from. Give it the action of what you want it to do, and then give it a role. So if you want to check all those boxes, that's number one. That's a good way to do it. A second one is just vibe prompting, where you just seriously just put on your voice thing, or just type and say, listen, I have to do this thing. I don't know where to start. How can you help me? Yeah, but I tried that and this didn't work. And you just make it a conversation back and forth, like you're talking to a friend, just going off the vibes, which works too. Christopher Penn, who is a mentor of mine when it comes to AI, actually has a great prompt that forces the AI to ask you questions to get what you want. So if you just say, I want to do this thing, I need you to ask me questions one at a time until you have enough information to to build it for me or to write a really great prompt. So that AI-led prompting. And then finally, there are some amazing GPTs right within ChatGPT. I have a favorite. It's called Prompt Maker, where you just say, I need a prompt that will do this. And it will write you a fully detailed, optimized prompt that follows all the frameworks, that has tons of context. And all you have to do is copy and paste that prompt and throw it in. So really, you can use a framework. You can go off vibes. You can do AI-led prompting where it helps you figure out step-by-step what to do, or you can use a GPT to write the prompt for you. I usually use a GPT to write a prompt for me just because it does a really, really good job. And it knows how to optimize for itself, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've kind of gone around in circles on that kind of idea too. And I'm turning more and more to making it more of that conversation. And I think that's been super helpful for a lot of things that I've done. And I think the only thing for me with that part of it is turning the microphone on and listening to myself talk to myself. I get kind of self-conscious, especially if there's other people around. So
those people at the airport that just full on talks on full volume with no headphones, or just have private conversations walking on the subway without caring who hears.
Yeah, that's not me, but I'm trying to, you know, I've got goals. I've got things that I'm trying to work. Okay. Let's 50 or 35 36 minutes here. I lost where we are, David. So here's why we record and then we can cut little parts out.
Works for me.
I was muted. Sorry. So the next one is the insights from the keynote stage.
Okay, perfect.
And you can, if we want to shift, I know a lot of your work, you've been doing AI, but you can either do it generally speaking, because it's the question is, you're constantly taking the pulse of the education community with the keynotes and things that you're doing, and it's about fears and misconceptions about AI, but I didn't know if you guys wanted to take it like more broadly. Either way,
whatever you want.
Okay, so I'll frame this question here somehow and then feel free. So Rebecca, as someone who gets the opportunity to travel to be a speaker, a presenter, a keynoter at many different gatherings of educators within the education community, or even as a host of your own podcast, right? You're taking the pulse of education wherever you go and you're interacting with those people. What do you think are some of the most common fears, most common misconceptions that you hear from people in your audience? And what do you do to try to address that?
There's definitely no shortage of fear and misconceptions. That's kind of the nature of this technology that came out so fast and is moving so fast that people don't understand. I think the biggest kind of sentiment that I hear is that just people are super overwhelmed. They don't know where to start. It's just this information saturation. Like, they're starting to be like, oh, this matters. This is a big deal. Like, where do I start? I'm already so busy. I'm overwhelmed. My administration or whoever has told me that this is cheating. So now I feel a certain way about it going in, or I'm not allowed to use it, but I feel like I should be learning it. Or, you know, people just feel really uncertain and overwhelmed. So that's a really common sentiment. They know it matters. They just don't know where to start necessarily. Or they just don't understand like the what's in it for me. Like, yeah, okay, cool. Everyone's talking about this. It's bright and shiny, but I just don't think it's for me. I don't think it can help me. It doesn't seem useful. I don't need something that will write me funny birthday poems. And so I think the best way to kind of address some of those things is, I do think there's got to be like a hook, right? Like, there's always something that there probably was for you guys too, that made you be like, oh, that could actually be really helpful for me. And once you figured that out, you started digging in deeper again to figure out how much that could help you. It could help you in this way now. And so I think really the only way to kind of get comfortable with using generative AI is to just kind of start playing with it a little bit. And if you need a place to start, the good news is all of the main labs, like, there's no shortage of free resources. And I know there's like, here's a free course, or, you know, a course on 20 ways to prompt AI, or here's a prompt library of 1,000 prompts, or really just go to OpenAI, Anthropic's Claude, Google Gemini. They all have AI Basic 101 free classes that you can use to help you get started, or just get a free ChatGPT account. Don't sign up with your school account. Keep it totally separate. Keep it personal, work for a lot of reasons. But then just start experimenting with whatever you're working on right then, or whatever you're passionate about. Say you're the president of your local aviation club or your model car club. Just go and start having a conversation with ChatGPT, asking it questions about it or what you should do, or planning an event. See where it fails. See where you know more and you can tell that it's wrong, and just start dipping your toe in a little bit. Or if you're at a school, ask some of the kids about it. Like, have a kid in your life show it to you and teach it to you so you can understand how it works from their point of view and their lens. Because really, a good practice is having learning from kids, right? Like having that sort of be an interactive learning process. But also, it's a good opportunity to get into their minds about it, because they understand it. They're using it, like they get it. But you just have to kind of understand it a little bit better and be vulnerable, which is hard for a lot of teachers. And this is an interesting space that I'm exploring right now, because the whole like transformative learning process starts with this disorienting dilemma. It's this moment in time where suddenly nothing is the same anymore, and you're struggling, and you're in this messy in-between space where you thought you knew everything, and now suddenly you realize you don't know. And it's an unsettling place to be. And a lot of us as adults haven't been there in a really long time. And I think it's a good opportunity to remember that this is how students feel all the time. And it's okay to sit in the unknown for a bit and to not know everything and to be open to being a learner and taking the time to experiment and explore with how this can help you specifically. Even like putting on your own oxygen mask before you can even help students with it. You just need to invest some time in understanding it for yourself.
I think that's a really good point. I think if you want true, meaningful learning to take place, that learner has to experience some sort of discomfort and be in that area where they do feel the chaos going on around them, and now they have to try to figure it out. And I think that's, you know, where I think, like you said, I think many educators are feeling at this time of AI is that they haven't lived in that uncomfortable space for a period of time. They aren't necessarily being empathetic with the students that they're with, and that this is kind of what they're feeling, you know, 6-7 hours a day as they travel to all of these different classes that they're being asked to take. So that connected with me. It resonated.
And one of the things too, that we're seeing more and more is the kind of, now that the tools are out there and teachers are starting to use them, there becomes a question about assessments. Is there, what is your thoughts on some of the things that have come out or that you've seen, like in some of our conversations? And we had a chance to interview Leon Furs, who's a researcher out of Australia. And, you know, there are some researchers and folks that are developing assessment scales or, you know, frameworks for assessing students. But then we also hear like, okay, we're not quite at the student part yet. And so while it's great that we have folks that are working towards some of that, and I think maybe you had mentioned this too, is that the teachers haven't quite wrapped their heads around use of these tools. So have you had a chance to talk with anybody about assessments or what that could look like when a student is using AI? Because most of the framework so far, the AI is integrated at, it's like depth. So there's levels to the assessment with AI use. What are some of your thoughts there? Have you had a chance to talk with some folks in that space?
I have strong opinions. So I am dead set on every fiber of my being against AI detection tools. And I don't think that AI should ever be used for assessment, period. For a lot of reasons, there's a lot of ethical issues connected to that. There are a lot of glorious fails connected to. For example, in the UK, a few years ago, they decided they were going to use AI to grade all of their, you know, the equivalent of like a state level or diploma exam in Canada, something that, like a standardized test that decides whether you get into university or not. And it went horribly wrong. They realized that after the fact, after it graded everybody, that part of the model's own learning had been that kids from private schools typically get 12% higher than kids from public schools. And that was a pattern it learned on its own. So it applied that pattern to every paper that it graded. And they had to go back, remark them all. The next year, they had a huge surge of kids getting into college who didn't get into college the first time because the AI failed. So the truth is, we don't understand about how these tools are working in the background, making decisions, why they're giving you a 69 and you a 73. We can't ask them questions because we can't believe what they say. We know they're embedded with bias, things that we might not even understand, right? It might be on a kid's name. It might be on a story that they told, and we can't push it. A parent comes in and says, why did my kid get a 74 on this? You can't tell them. So I just don't think there's a level of transparency there that is, and that's important. I think there are real questions around consent. A kid doesn't consent to having their work put into an AI model for those purposes, because the reality is most ed tech tools are training their models on the work that are put into them, which means that, you know, you're putting kids' work in there without their consent, and it's becoming part of a training data set. And a lot of these are just notoriously unreliable, is the truth. They, the AI detection tools, sorry, I'm just going to make sure I'm on do not disturb here. I'll start in a second again here. A lot of these tools are notoriously unreliable, especially the AI detection tools. They unfairly flag English as a second language speakers. They really can't tell if you or I were to put in like our master's dissertation from 15 years ago, it would be flagged as AI generated. I don't think there's any way around that. And I just don't think we should be using them. I think just in the same way that we're saying to kids, like, don't use AI, it's cheating. Like, we should be looking at that ourselves and being like, the most important part of teaching is this part that helps you get to know a student better. It's important that this is right because the stakes are high. So let's not outsource that. Maybe that needs to be human-led and human-directed.
And do you think too, like with the, when teachers are designing assessments as well, is there a good way to do that to, you know, allow students certain access to things? Obviously some of the tools that we've seen, like a Magic School AI or School AI, they've been working on some of that with their, like the student rooms and things where you can issue these tools, but there's no sign-in required and there's some anonymity to it. Is there, when teachers are designing assessments, what do you think as far as that goes with what should we be giving students and what should we refrain from at this point?
Oh, that's tricky. Again, I don't know what we should be endorsing as teachers until we understand it properly and the implications and the risks. So I have questions about that. But again, someone needs to be teaching these kids how to be using these tools responsibly. So if you have, let's say, a sandboxed rubric GPT within an ed tech tool that you have that acts as you, the teacher, and gives the rubric and kids can put in their assignments, probably like you're alluding to, and have it. But again, part of me struggles because your school's paying thousands of dollars for that tool. If we just teach a kid how to use a free version of ChatGPT properly, they can just put in the rubric and have it support them in that way. And then they're learning how to use the tool and schools maybe have enough money to buy another teacher instead of spending all of their money on bright, shiny ed tech tools. That's, again, yeah, a small opinion.
And one of the things, too, that we've seen more and more is there's some folks that are talking about like localized models of these. So a district would have their kind of their own in-house. It would be like siloed and whatever interactions happen with that would just remain there because it would be a localized version of a GPT or large language model.
And that could be a good option. Like, I run local models myself. Again, something to consider. From an ethicist point of view, is making sure that kids know Everything you put in there, the district can see, and we might, you know, that you might train your district model on it, or it might be traced back to you. I remember like how jarring it was for me to realize that all of these kids' school accounts, and it makes sense in hindsight through Google, the administration could manage and flag keywords that kids were searching, you know, for their safety, but also see everything that was going on in these kids' lives, this type of surveillance. And it just made me a little uncomfortable. And so we just would need to make sure that there was transparency around some of that. There's just a lot of ethical questions around even having your own model. Is it better than outsourcing it to an outside place? Absolutely. But you'd have to make sure it was very, very secure and that you were transparent about how it was used and what was happening that way. So
you talk about like some of those, you know, like training kids how to use ChatGPT appropriately being effective. Like, what other sorts of skills do you think would be important? I'm on a switch maybe to it could be teachers as teachers are learning how to use it, but even as we transition into a tool for students as well, what are some of those critical skills then that we should be focusing on that are agnostic of a particular tool, but are just critical for using generative AI?
Honestly, I think it's more about the process. I think that co-creation process that maybe students and teachers should be learning on alongside each other and co-creating like assessments that, you know, would work and that students give feedback on what works and what doesn't. But I think just the basics, like what you're talking about, like how to effectively chat with these tools, where the line is between this is how you engage with them to further thinking, and here's where it becomes like it's not helping you at all. Maybe discussions around that cognitive offloading or going back to the why this is important or how you can use this to make you think better and smarter. Maybe having kids critically analyze AI outputs or experiment with generating images and examining where the bias and the stereotypes are. So I think the biggest kind of cross-platformal, whatever skill is teaching kids how to think critically about AI outputs and their AI use. So how to do it effectively so that they're complementary offloading and not, competitively cognitive offloading. I think one of my favorite stories about this is actually that London cab drivers and ambulance drivers never die from Alzheimer's, which is fascinating to me in terms of cognitive offloading, because they have to memorize and not rely on GPS entire maps of the cities. And every day they have to think through the best way to get from here to there without a GPS. And they have to be actively thinking about those things every single day. And the research is actually fascinating because they're thinking all the time and it doesn't lead to the cognitive decline. So how do we complementary cognitive offload to AI in a way that complements our thinking instead of a way that competes with our thinking? I think that's the most critical skill, and how to challenge and think critically about the outputs that AI creates. I think those are the two big skills.
So as you start to look forward here, and I know this is really difficult to do, but we like to ask this question, and you know, if you can answer best you can answer, I'm going to give you two dates here. What does AI look like in September 2026, in your opinion? And what does it look like in September 2030?
I think in 2026, I think it will be very similar to what we have now. I don't think we're going to see these orders of magnitude changes. I think, you know, if I looked at it 2 years ago, the basics are kind of like, yeah, it's way better. But you interact with it, you get a response. I think that part is going to be the same. And I think there'll still be people who don't think it matters and thinks it's a fad. But I think they'll be a little too late by that time. So I think it looks the same. I think just more people will be figuring out how to use it. As more people figure out how to use it effectively, we'll come up with better ideas and better use cases. But people are barely using some of the amazing ways that you can use AI now, like the Notebook LM thing. I can give that a research paper and then have the hosts fight about it like it's celebrity gossip. And, you know, like all of these different ways that you can interrogate your thinking. I don't think we'll see, and I don't know, anything massively different. I do wonder by 2030, I just think wearables are going to be a bigger deal than they are now. We're already seeing the AI glasses. I have a pair. And, you know, those are in schools. It's not like the most amazing technology in the world, but it's, you know, behind the scenes, it's getting pretty good. And what does it mean once, you know, everybody's wearing their technology or they don't carry phones anymore, right? Like it all becomes wearables. And I think, you know, we've heard about Johnny Ives and Sam Altman working on something new that's not a phone, that's, we don't know what it is, but they say it'll be on your desk with your computer and your phone and this thing. So we don't know what that is, but if it's a big deal, it might change if kids have those in schools, right? So what does that look like and how can kids be learning with those things? We'll probably ban them right away, but, you know, how do we make sense of those things? You know, we're so far behind. We just finally banned cell phones in schools. And so it'll be interesting to see. In terms of AI, though, I think that we're getting as far as we can with the interfaces, like the computer and the phone interfaces. I think we'll be using voice a lot more. I think we'll have more wearables and interactions, like almost like the kind of sci-fi thing you think about where maybe I don't have a 3-monitor setup. Maybe I do have whatever, if Apple finally gets it together, their headset is or whatever. And I just have my full office and everything with me. And then what does that mean for students? If you don't need a computer in every classroom for every student and things happen this way and it's a lot more virtual, that's why we need to start thinking about these very basic rudimentary things now, like large language models that give you maybe right answers so that we can stay caught up when things get released. So by 2030, I think we'll have more wearables. I don't think it'll be like science fiction, but I think we'll be using AI in a lot of different ways than we are right now.
Yeah, great. Thank you. So what we've kind of been ending some of our episodes here with is we put the guest on the spot here with some rapid fire kind of lightning round type questions. And so David and I will kind of alternate here. Feel free to, if you want a one word answer, that's great. If you want to give a little bit of explanation to your answer, it's kind of whatever you choose, right?
Yeah.
So I guess I'll get to go with the first one. And this one is kind of right up my alley because actually you talked about what was that hook that got you into using AI. And for me, it was cooking. My first question that to kick it off then is, what's the best food in Canada?
Oh, you know, I don't know if Canada's known for their food. The maple syrup is pretty fire, I guess. Poutine at our Costco's, we have poutine. So it's the good Costco fries with big chunks of cheese and gravy. That's a fan favorite, but all of my favorite foods are at different cities in the U.S.
Okay. So the next question is, this is a LinkedIn reference. If you maybe, I saw it. I don't know if everybody follows Rebecca, but you should because there's a lot of great stuff there on her profile. But also, you recently posted about getting work done in your PJs, and there was a picture of you. So can you, in fact, get work done in your PJs?
I can confirm I am actually wearing pajamas right now on the bottom. So I basically live in my pajamas. I am business up top, all comfy on the bottom.
All right. At least we're putting it to bed. No pun
mentioned. You need a mom of four.
Yep.
What's one piece of parenting advice that you would give to parents about their children's interactions with technology and or AI?
Ask them about it. Ask them to teach you about it. Ask them to tell you how they're using it. Have conversations about it. Ask them how they feel about, like, if it's cheating. Find out what their professors are saying about it, because I'm in a unique position where, like, I know when their teachers are telling them information that is wrong and it's super annoying, right? So a kid will come home and say, well, I'm not allowed to use AI. It's cheating. And if they put it in an AI detector and it comes back, then I'm kicked out of the class. And I'm like, bet I will fight to the death against that AI detector for you, or that's actually not true, or they can't do that, or AI is not cheating if you use it like this. And so talk to your kids about it, because honestly, there's a lot of harm being done. I have one kid in college who lives in this constant state of heightened anxiety that he's going to be unfairly flagged by an AI detector and kicked out of his program, even though he's too scared to use AI because he was so brainwashed about it in high school. And so talk to your kids about it and have them teach you about it and what their teachers are saying about it. If you don't know anything, have them teach you. But if you do know something, then help challenge their own critical thinking skills about it in good ways and in bad ways. And you'll learn a lot in the process. And also, it'll make your kids feel safe to come to you and ask you questions about AI too.
All right. If you had to teach a large language model, AI, a human emotion, which one would you choose and why?
Honestly, like the timing on this probably sucks because over the last couple of weeks, I've lost a lot of faith in humanity. I'm not going to lie. Like I've been questioning whether we even want to teach AI to be human because there's just like a lot of really, you know, things happening in the world where you're just not seeing the best of humans and people. If it were possible, obviously compassion, empathy to be able to, it's not even possible to be able to feel the things that humans feel because it can demonstrate and appropriate empathy so well. But I think if I could teach humans to also have this thing, it would be compassion and empathy. Let's just give it to everybody.
Doesn't matter if it's robotic or human.
That's a priority.
Yeah. Yeah. So you live and work on a farm. What is one simple low-tech tool that you think will never, ever be replaced by AI?
Great question. Honestly, like, I still to this day cannot think properly without a pen in my hand. Like, I just think there's something to actually pen and paper sometimes. I think there'll always be a need for that. That's a great question, though. I'm trying to think of a good kind of low-tech tool because I am kind of a high-tech kind of gal and the world is kind of going that way a lot. But yeah, I've probably gone high tech in most areas of my life. I even have like a coffee mug that stays hot all day. So that's not even like a uniquely...
That's essential. That is, yeah.
So, but that's a great question because that's going to be one I'm going to be thinking about all day. And I'll probably come up with a really good answer probably later tonight. But, you know, maybe a good book. There's something for actually like holding a book and turning pages in your hands that, yes, you can do high tech, but nothing quite replaces that experience in my mind.
Well, if you think about it, be sure to let us know.
I will.
And Rebecca, we've just really appreciated you taking the time to spend with us. And we thought it was just a great, insightful conversation. And I hope there's a lot of takeaways from it that our listeners will get.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much for having me on and happy to chat anytime. Maybe we'll revisit some of those predictions I made in 2026 and again in 2030 and we'll see where it all ended up.
We'll make sure to hold you to them.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Integrate This. Want to take your learning further? Head over to our YouTube channel for quick tutorials, deep dives, and more EdTech tips you can use right away. Don't forget to subscribe and catch new podcast episodes every Thursday on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, keep exploring, keep innovating, and keep integrating this.